This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. A little bit later in the hour, primatologist Franz de Waal is here to talk about animal intelligence and why we shouldn't underestimate the cognitive capacities of even, yes, insects. But first, one of the hot topics taught in middle school earth science is, of course, volcanoes. Who hasn't made one of those models that spewed out baking soda and vinegar? And you probably learned that volcanoes form when two tectonic plates crash into each other. But that's not the case for a volcano on the border of North Korea and China. And just as interesting is the politics of the situation. Maggie Kurth-Baker is here to tell us that story and other short subjects in science. She's a senior science writer for 538.com, based out of Minneapolis, and she joins us from NPR Studios. Welcome back, Maggie. My heart goes out to all you folks in Minneapolis today, remembering Prince.
We are getting by as best we can.
All right. Maybe we can change what's on our minds a little bit just for the next few moments. So let's talk about what's going on there. This is a mysterious volcano for, what, a few different reasons?
Well, so it's a really interesting volcano. So we know that about 1,000 years ago, Mount Paektu is what it's called, had one of the biggest volcanic eruptions that we have any record of. On a scale of 8, this was a 7. And it's also interesting because it is a sacred volcano, both to the North Koreans and to the Manchu ethnic group of Chinese. Mm-hmm. When Kim Il-sung took over North Korea, he actually set up a legend that he'd been born there as part of legitimizing his leadership. So it's important culturally, it's important scientifically, and it's also got this weird thing where it's not on the border of where the tectonic plates meet. It's kind of in the middle of solid earth. So there's all these interesting things happening with it, but nobody had really been able to study it from the Western science perspective because it was sitting there in North Korea. And then in 2011, a group of British and Chinese researchers were invited to come to North Korea and actually study the interior plumbing, get into the guts of this volcano with seismometers and understand what was going on with it.
That seems unusual. I mean, in North Korea, you know, is so close to Westerners. Isn't that a little bit unusual that they would allow British scientists to come in there? Again.
It is a little bit unusual, but there's actually a couple of different groups, international organizations that have been working on building scientific connections between other countries and North Korea as a way of improving diplomacy and spreading information to the North Koreans. And this is just one of those groups that has been involved here, although this is the first time that those kind of scientific collaborations have actually resulted in research published in a major journal.
So this could be like ping pong diplomacy opened up China. This might, volcano diplomacy might open up North Korea.
It's a possibility.
Okay. Let's move on to your next story. It's kind of interesting. Also, your story looks at how Alzheimer's affects HIV patients. Wow.
Yeah. So this is another really fascinating thing. Researchers identified the first person living with HIV who now also has Alzheimer's. It might have happened before, but this is the first time that it's been recorded. And this is part of this really changing situation where you have people in Western countries, in Europe, in the US, who are over the age of 65 and living with HIV. And this is, it's hard to explain to younger people, I think, just what a huge deal this is, that when some of these people were first diagnosed with HIV, they expected to live months, weeks, you know, certainly not years. Many of them, you know, quit their jobs. They lost everyone in their family, like everyone who was part of their emotional support system often also had AIDS, and many of those people died. And Aaron Alday did a story last month for the San Francisco Chronicle that followed the lives of some men who were now, you know, in their 60s, in their 70s, living with AIDS, and just what a huge cultural and social impact they had by having the situation where they thought they were going to be dead at 30, and now they're elderly.
So they themselves weren't even prepared to survive for that
role. No, not at all. Not at all. And so now you have this population that is going into old age and is getting the diseases of old age on top of the diseases of AIDS. And in many cases, they also don't have support systems, don't have savings, haven't had jobs in years because that wasn't the future they were planning for.
Wow, that is quite interesting and a challenge because the population is aging. Let's move on to another topic that is very much in the news, and that's climate change. And we're finding now that climate change is having some unforeseen consequences, opening up the Northwest Passage over the North Pole. No one expected that. Either.
I know, yeah. Finally proving somebody right from 1400. This is such an interesting thing to me because it's, you know, the early history of European colonization is all about finding this Northwest Passage that can take ships from the Atlantic to the Pacific without having to go all the way around South America or all the way around the world the other direction. And nobody ever found it. You know, they sent Lewis and Clark out looking for this thing, and they couldn't find it. All these explorers died on ships stuck in the ice in the Arctic and never found it. And now, because
of climate change, they built the Panama Canal so they wouldn't have to do that, yeah?
Yeah, and now there's enough ice melt happening that, at least for certain parts of the year, there is a Northwest Passage through the Arctic. And China is now setting itself up to start using that to haul freight from the Pacific to the Atlantic. So, for example, if you're going from Shanghai to Hamburg, if you take the Arctic route, that's 2,800 nautical miles less than if they went through the Suez Canal and went that direction. So it could save money, it could save time. The trouble is that it could also be an international incident. Because there's a lot of debate about whether that Northwest Passage is international waters or whether it's something owned by Canada.
Yeah, and all the bordering Arctic countries, all the way from, you know, Scandinavia to Canada, U.S., they're all claiming, you know, they're all gearing up for a fight over this, aren't they?
Yeah, they definitely are. And there's actually a lot of raised eyebrows about China's kind of casual way of kind of deciding that they're going to start doing this shipping. Their Maritime Safety Administration released a guide that offers route guidance to captains so that they can go through that. And they're going to start encouraging ships that are flying their flag to take that route.
That's what we need is another flashpoint in the world. All right, Maggie. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Our condolences to all of you in Minneapolis today.
Thank you for having me.
Maggie Kurth-Baker is a senior science reporter at 538.com in Minneapolis. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And we're going to talk about the flip side about lab mice, really. The furry four-legged cornerstone of medical research that help us investigate everything from obesity to sleep to tumor growth. And to ensure studies using them are both humane and scientifically appropriate, the National Research Council recommends that mice be kept in rooms that are between 68 and 79 degrees Fahrenheit. Many researchers don't even bother reporting what temperature they keep their mice at, but one group suggests that it is time to pay closer attention to that thermostat. So what might be good or bad about how warm or cold a mouse is? Here to explain is Ike Swetzlitz. He's senior reporter at STAT. He's been covering the story for the publication. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, why does the temperature of the room a mouse is kept in matter for research?
So the temperature of a room that the mice is in impacts a lot of things about the mouse's physiology. If the room is very cold, the mouse will expend a lot of energy trying to heat itself up, basically, then that impacts the results of a variety of experiments. The mouse is very stressed, right? Imagine if you were in a room that was freezing cold, you could put on some clothes, but a mouse can't really just put on clothes. So its heart rate will go up, and that can have impact on a lot of things from how tumors grow to how effective cancer therapies can be.
All right, so that's the bad thing about keeping them at cool temperature. What's the good thing?
So it's really good for the humans who are working with them, because when you're working with mice, you have to wear a lot of protective equipment, some depending on the type of mice or the diseases they may be carrying. You might have to wear masks or ventilators, and if you're in a room that's really hot, you're gonna be very uncomfortable. So keeping a room at a low temperature makes it easy for the researchers to work. It also cuts down on the odors in the room at lower temperatures, and there are a variety of other benefits as well. Mice are less aggressive at lower temperatures, and you don't want the mice killing each other in the process of your experiment. So there are a variety of advantages as well.
So the fact that the mice are kept in this cold temperature, is that affecting all the research? Is it invalidating all the research, you know, from years past?
So a recent review article that was published that sort of summarizes the research in this field didn't go that far, right? Mm-hmm. It brought together a number of studies that showed how temperature impacts different aspects of mouse physiology, but it hasn't gone so far as to invalidate any particular study. The authors of the review are more calling on researchers to take temperature into account in ways they may not have before, but weren't pointing out specific ways in which studies might be invalid because
So at least if you're going to do the research, document the temperature it's being done in, so we can use that as part of the paperwork.
Right.
Yeah, we can judge from there. Thank you, Ike. Very interesting. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Ike Swetlitz is a science reporter at STAT, based out of Boston. When we come back, we're going to talk to Franz de Waal. He's here to take us on the tour of intelligence in the animal kingdom. They're smarter than you think, or maybe you already know that. Depends if you have a pet or not, I think. Stay with us. We'll talk with Franz de Waal right after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. By now, you've heard the story of Inky the octopus, who under the cover of darkness squeezed through a crack in his tank top, stretched his long body through a drain hole in the floor, and slithered down a 50-meter pipe to make his escape into the sea from the National Aquarium of New Zealand. Quite impressive. Unless you're a pet owner, because if you have a pet, I'm guessing you've had moments where you think, hey, this pet is really smart and clever and conniving. But how smart? How do you measure the IQ of a cat or an octopus? Well, until recently, we humans haven't done a great job at assessing the intelligence of animals. We're just too prejudiced by our own intelligence, our own way of solving problems, of looking at the world. We think we're so smart, but then we do dumb things, like asking animals to solve human puzzles. When they struggle, we pat ourselves on the backs, assured at our place at the top of the intelligence totem pole. So how can we give animals a fair shake? Well, a good place to start, according to my next guest, would be, well, an elephant. Test elephant smarts on elephant terms. And he documents our quest to measure animal intelligence and emotions in his new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And it's not just about chimps and our next of kin. After you read this book, you may never look at a wasp the same way again. Franz de Waal is a primatologist at Emory University in Atlanta. He joins us here in our New York studios, and you can read an excerpt of the book on our site at sciencefriday.com/smartanimals. Welcome back, Dr. DeWall.
Glad to be here, yeah.
Nice to have you. Let me just start with the name of your book,
mm-hmm.
Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Are we?
I hope we are, and I think we could be, but for the last 100 years we haven't really shown it because we have been downplaying animal intelligence for 100 years. Animals either worked on the basis of instinct or on the basis of associative learning, you know, like reward and punishment. And already in the previous century, there were people who disagreed with that, like Wolfgang Köhler, the German scientist who would hang a banana high up in the ceiling and see, he would give his chimps a bunch of boxes and see if they use them to get there. And he would describe that his chimps would sit around for a long time and stare at the boxes, and then all of a sudden they would jump up and stack a few boxes together. So they were performing a behavior that they never had been rewarded for, but which was the right behavior to get to the banana. And he called it insight. And the behaviorists and all the opponents of animal intelligence, they got crazy. They really didn't like to hear that animals could think, you know.
You know, when I was in college, we had a psych lab, and I had a psychologist who told me that, and he worked in the chimp lab, and they would measure intelligence just like you say. They put a banana on a shelf, they would leave a stick around, and they would see if he could pick up the stick and knock off the banana. Mm-hmm. And what the chimp did, he balanced himself on the end of the stick and reached up with his arm and grabbed the banana.
Yeah, we recently repeated the Köhler test at the Arnhem Zoo where I used to work, and we put a whole bunch of boxes out there and the bananas high up. And we had a female who did something that Köhler never described and no one has ever described. She picked up a box and she threw it at the banana, which was very smart and it worked very well. And so why not, you know?
So you said it's sort of useless to ask whether humans are more intelligent than say an octopus, right? I talked about the octopus knew how to get out.
It's not a good question.
Yeah.
Are you smarter than an octopus? Is that a good question?
What should we be asking, and how should we be testing them then?
We should be asking, the octopus obviously has cognition going, because cognition is the processing of information. And so how is it shaped? What can he do? What does he use it for? How does he survive through his cognitive solutions to certain problems, like camouflage or putting coconut shells around yourself or the kind of things? So how does he solve the problems in his environment? And how it compares to humans is sort of a secondary issue in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Because animals don't have to do the things we do, right? But they have to be smart about what they do in their own world.
Yeah, and also if you test them on our terms, which we've been doing for the longest time, and you find negative results, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. So, for example, elephants have been tested on tool use. You put food outside of their cage, you give them a stick, and you see if they want to do that. And elephants don't do anything with the stick, whereas a chimp would immediately retrieve the food that way. And so they concluded that elephants don't have the capacity for tool use. But when they hung up a banana high and they gave the elephant boxes, he would stand on it, and he would actually bring the boxes in from long distances to stand on the box and reach the food. And so they concluded, yes, they use tools, but they don't want to use their trunk to shut off their smelling organ in order to use tools. And so the elephant is a different animal than a chimp. Right. And a chimp is, again, different from us, and you need to test them on their own terms.
And speaking of chimps, you say in your book that people once tried testing chimps' facial recognition by showing them human faces. I mean, how well would we do if we had to recognize chimp faces?
Yeah, this was for the longest time. Apes and monkeys were said not to recognize faces. And so that human face recognition was absolutely unique. And then at some point I learned that they were testing all these animals on human faces. And so we started testing chimps on chimp faces, and they were perfectly good at it. And now, of course, we know that sheep can recognize faces, that wasps can recognize faces.
But you know, anybody who has a pet, mm-hmm. and my kids have dogs and I'm around them all the time, you know that there's something more going on in their head.
Yeah.
But you're afraid to say anything. Right? You shouldn't be afraid to say, I know the dog looks like it's smiling, and the dog is anticipating my actions. If I throw the ball, it gets ready. It's eager to do these things.
Of course, they anticipate actions. They're predators. That's their whole business, is to anticipate actions. And people are sometimes overly afraid of anthropomorphism, because that's bad, to ascribe human emotions or thoughts to animals. I would argue that we loosen up a little bit on that. I don't say that for everything your dog does, you need to come up with a high-level interpretation. But
it's okay for cats, though, right?
Oh, cats. but for example, a simple term like jealousy, which sounds very anthropomorphic. If you define jealousy as being sensitive to the relations of your best friend, to other relations and so on, you can define it in a way that it's completely acceptable term in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Franz, we are here in an election season, and I know that you actually started your career in chimpanzee politics. What's that? What was that all about?
Yeah, chimpanzee politics is how chimps form coalitions to achieve power. A chimp male on his own physical abilities cannot really achieve power. He needs supporters. And so chimp males, when they vie for positions, for example, they they will try to get female support by tickling the babies of the females and holding them up, a bit like what the political candidates are doing. I'm very interested in this season because Hillary Clinton is obviously different. She's a female, and she doesn't hold her babies nearly as much as all these male contenders are doing. And my theory is that males need to prove to the community that they are good with kids and you can trust them with kids. A female doesn't need to prove that. We assume that. We're mammals after all this, so females are probably better at this kind of stuff.
Wow, that is an interesting... I hadn't heard that theory.
Yeah.
Interesting.
New theory, okay.
I like that. And speaking of, you talk about the holding the chimps. You've written about how a baby chimp will laugh when you tickle it, but people object to using the term laugh.
Yeah, I run into that all the time. I discovered that chimpanzees reconcile after fights, and people would say you need to call it post-conflict contact with mouth-to-mouth contact or something. So they come up with these terminologies that avoid the connection with human behavior. And I feel we, especially with apes, for other species we can have a discussion about it, but especially with apes, we need to honor the connection by using the same language for the sort of things that they do.
Is that because when you talk about apes, we have a common ancestry,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that's where we both learned how to laugh somehow?
Yeah, so the laughing in response to tickling, which for a chimp is something like that kind of sound that they make. So that... We call it laughing, usually, but there's always people who object to that. You have to call it laugh-like vocalizations or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So people try to create distance where there is really not much distance. Now, if you go to, let's say, fish behavior or turtle behavior, yes, I can understand that mouth-to-mouth contact should maybe not be called a kiss because it's maybe not functioning as a kiss.
Right. Our number, 844-724-8255. If you just joined us, we're talking with Franz De Waal, who's a primatologist at Emory University, and he's got a great new book out. It's called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And you can also tweet us at SciFry. You know, most people don't think of insects as having any flies, stuff like that, you know, being the brainiest creatures around.
Mm-hmm.
But you write that wasps, for example, are actually very good at facial recognition.
Yeah, so there are certain wasps, paper wasps, that live in small hierarchical societies where every member needs to know every other member and needs to know its place. And those wasps, they have special yellow-black patches in the face, and the others, they recognize them by them. And there are related wasps, closely related ones, that don't have that and don't live in that kind of societies, and they don't have face recognition. And this illustrates an interesting point, is you have the capacities that you need. So if you live in a society where it is good to recognize other individuals, you're going to develop that ability. If you don't need it, you don't develop it. And this is true for, I think, all sorts of cognitions in the animal kingdom. They're always related to what are the requirements of my environment.
Mm-hmm. So they can see, the wasp can see as many faces, and it needs to see a lot of faces
mm-hmm.
that we would never be able to recognize.
Yeah, we would probably not be able to recognize wasps now.
Do animals have what we think of as culture? That's always something that defines humanity, right?
Oh, there's so many studies on animal culture. It started with Imanishi in Japan. I don't think it's accidental that it was someone from the East who came up with the concept of animal culture, because in the West we were really not ready for that, because the anthropologists, they would say culture is what makes us human. Well, if you say that, then of course there's no room for animal culture. So Imanishi said that if you can learn behavior from each other, and as a result, one group of the same species may act quite differently from another group of the same species, he said we should call it culture. And his students very soon thereafter started discovering certain traditions among the monkeys in Japan. And then now it has spread to studies of culture in whales or in orangutans or certainly in chimpanzees and so on.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about emotional intelligence animals have. Do you see that sort of thing beyond primates and the mammals? Emotional intelligence.
Yeah, the connection to the emotions of others, which I call empathy, for example, is very developed in the mammals, but there are now studies on birds, and I'm actually involved in a study on fish, believe it or not. But we recently had this study on voles, and because there are many rodent studies now on empathy, on how you relate to the emotions of others, you're affected by the emotions of others. So, for example, consolation behavior, as I call it, mm-hmm. which chimpanzees do. Let's say someone is distressed and they go over to that individual and they embrace and kiss. Consolation has now been documented in many species, and anyone who has a dog probably has experience with it also.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question that's coming in from the internet, from our mm-hmm. people are tweeting us. Did your guest, meaning you, contribute to Francis Fukuyama's Origins of Political Order? Is that where I first heard of primate politics work?
That's interesting. I think Fukuyama mentioned my book, and he related to my book. He wrote this book, The End of History, which, as we have seen, has not really happened, the end of history. But and I think he quoted chimpanzee politics in there.
Mm-hmm. Our number, 844-724-8255, talking with Franz Dewall on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Let's see. Let me grab the phone. Go to our phone calls here. Let's go to Jillian in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, this is Joanne, sorry. I was calling about animal grief. We had three cats at one time when I was a child, and one of them died. And when we buried the one, the other two just hung around the grave meowing, and they were obviously distressed. And I wonder what your guest thinks about that.
Yeah, I think all animals that have attachments, they're going to have strong reactions to the death of somebody else. They may also have strong reactions to the disappearance of someone else. Hmm. But if they can see the body and how still it is, and, for example, especially, if a female loses her own offspring, but also between mates, there are many stories on birds, bonded birds, you know, where one of the mates dies and a couple of weeks later, I've had it happen to some of my own birds, where a couple of weeks later, then another one dies. And so as soon as you get attachments, you get strong responses to the loss of somebody else, which is very logical because attachment is that you see each other on a regular basis and enjoy that kind of company.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
And sorry to hear about your animals. Let's go to Mary in St. Louis. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Nice to talk to you both. I had a comment, and I was just going to say, I've always wondered, ever since I was kind of little, why it's so difficult for humans to understand that we're not the only ones who could possibly relate to our environment and other beings in such an intelligent and or emotional, maybe even spiritual way. Like, what is it holding us back? I don't understand, like, the problem.
Yeah, so that's something I'm struggling with in the book, is like, why do we always want to compare animals to us and we need to come out as the smartest of them all? And why have we for such a long time declared them dumb, basically, and not seen how smart they are? And there's, of course, a religious component to it, in the sense that I call it neo-creationism, is that there are people, even in philosophy and in psychology and anthropology, people who feel that, yes, we are a product of evolution, but not our mind. Our mind is sort of totally special and totally separate. It's a very non-evolutionary approach because in my mind, everything is connected and all the intelligences that we see in the animal kingdom mm-hmm. are somehow connected.
Well, a couple of last question I have for you. A couple of people are phoning in and say, could it be because we eat animals and we don't acknowledge their intelligence?
Well, there is a moral component to all of this, and that if you start farming, which we started about 15,000 years ago, we started farming, maybe you need to develop a different attitude to animals, and instead of respecting them or being even in admiration for them, you need to say, well, they're just animals and we can do whatever we want to do. So there is a moral component to this attitude.
So we don't, but we don't like to talk about eating whales and dolphins and things because we know they're intelligent. So it's a little more of a problem.
Yeah, but we eat pigs. So there are certain animals that are intelligent that we eat. Yeah.
All right. Franz Dewall, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome.
His new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Really great read, especially if you like animals and you want to know a little bit more about it. We have an excerpt from the book at sciencefriday.com/smartanimals. After the break, we're going to look at the state of the world's coral reefs and how they'll hold up with increasing temperatures and warmer waters. On this Earth Day, there's bad news in one of the world's biggest coral reefs in Australia. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Today is the 46th annual Earth Day, so we're going to check in on the state of one of the key organisms of the world's oceans, the coral reefs. The Great Barrier Reef in Australia has been hit by a massive bleaching. That's when warm waters cause corals to stress out and lose the colorful algae that give them oxygen. 93% of the Great Barrier Reef's corals have been affected. So what does this mean for corals worldwide, and how can we help protect these guardians of the deep? Let me introduce my guest. Mark Aiken is the coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch Program for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's based out of College Park, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Glad to be back on the show, Ira.
You're welcome. The flyover pictures of the Great Barrier Reef are devastating. What does it look like to you out there?
Oh, it's just horrible. Every time I've seen the images, whether it's the flyovers from the Great Barrier Reef, the diving photos of the bleached corals in the Great Barrier Reef, or some of the extremely bad damage from all the death of corals in Kiribati in the Central Pacific, these are all heartbreaking scenes, and they're going on all over the world.
And the cause of this particular bleaching event, is it warming waters?
Yes. In short, that's exactly what it is.
And we had a very strong El Nino this year. How does this contribute to these events?
So it's the combination of global warming and the El Nino that have led to what we're seeing. We're actually in a global bleaching event that started in June of 2014. So we've been going at this for almost 2 years now, long before this El Nino started, the bleaching began. And as that global warming has been raising temperatures and involved with other natural variability that's gone on, we've seen the warming go on in places across the Pacific and then across into the Indian Ocean and the Caribbean. And so, you know, when we had that and then we had this massive El Nino that's come in now, the combination of those two has led to just a major increase in the amount of bleaching.
You know, as a scuba diver, I've been diving for a few decades, and there are places I used to dive at in the Caribbean that don't have any coral anymore. There, I was just amazed to see that.
Absolutely. And the, you know, part of the shifting baseline problem is people will go diving there and think it's absolutely beautiful, having no idea what we've already lost.
Yeah, I once went with a dive in even in Hawaii, and they said this is where everybody go out and have lunch and take a look at the corals. And I went down and saw that everything was white, and I said to the dive master, you know, these are all dead. And he said, shh. Well, you know, don't tell the other tourists on these things. It's unbelievable. But bleaching, though, is sort of a natural event. But the climate has changed the cycle, right?
It is a natural response to warm water. But the problem is the warm water that these corals are seeing over this large an area is not something that they've seen before. So the natural response to warming is being hit with this huge amount of high temperature the corals are seeing right now across half of the southern hemisphere from Africa to French Polynesia.
You've predicted this is going to last for 9 more months. Is there something that can be done while this is happening? And how do you know, where do you come up with that figure for just 9 more months?
Well, it's not just 9 more months. It's at least 9 more months, I'm afraid.
At least 9 more months.
Yeah. The climate models that we have looking out forward at the temperatures, because what we do is we use satellites to look at the sea surface temperatures that cause coral bleaching and can use that to really predict well where bleaching is happening all over the world and help people to be ready to respond. But we also use climate models to look several months in advance. And that's allowed us to look out at this point through the end of the year and see that we're likely to have major bleaching going on in the Caribbean as well as other areas in the Northern Hemisphere. And this event we're in now may even bleed back over into the Southern Hemisphere in early 2017. So we're looking at an event that's going to be going for at least 2.5 years, probably a bit longer.
You know, we've had scientists come on, and now that Cuba is opening up a little bit more, it's getting a little more attention about having some of the most pristine coral in the world. They have marine parks, areas where the reefs are thriving, and no one's allowed to go there. Is that part of the reason they may be surviving?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, the less local human impact there is, the better shape the coral reefs are going to be. A lot of the reefs around the world have been affected by things like overfishing, like sediments, like nutrients, toxic pollutants, and of course, direct impact, ships grounding, people hitting reefs. There are a number of things that people tend to do that damages coral reefs around the world. And so the farther they are away from people, the healthier they are. But unfortunately, when you've got a big warming event like the one we're mm-hmm. seeing now, even the most remote reefs are being hit. So the area worst hit on the Great Barrier Reef right now is the northern third, which is where there are the least people. And the islands of Kiribati, around the Christmas Island and these other islands along the equatorial Pacific, where there are very, very few people and in some cases completely uninhabited, we're seeing over 80% mortality plus another 15% bleached right now. And so being remote is great, and it does a lot for helping the reefs, but it's not everything when we've got this problem of global warming sitting in front of us.
Yeah. World leaders are using this Earth Day as a time to sign the Paris Climate Change Agreements. I think they're in New York today at the UN. Will the agreement help the corals?
Absolutely. And you know what was amazing to me? I almost fell out of my chair when I saw that not only was the 2-degree limit in there, but even the aspirational goal of keeping it below 1.5 degrees Celsius warming above pre-industrial conditions, because we really need 1.5 degrees to help coral reefs survive. So having this agreement is great. Having the signing today is spectacular. Having the ratification in the next several months, even better. But the important thing we have to do is actually act on that agreement.
Can the corals bounce back if, you know, we change our ways?
They can. It's a slow process. It's a hard process. In the most remote, most spectacular places we have, after big bleaching events, reefs have managed to bounce back in 10 or 15 years. In other areas with more local disturbance, it's taken decades or hasn't happened. So, you know, we've got to do everything we can to protect them locally so that they have the best chance they can to bounce back from these events while we're dealing with the problem of the excess CO2 in the atmosphere.
All right. Mark, thank you for taking time to be with us today on this Earth Day. And we'll all be watching and waiting for see what happens with the corals.
You're welcome, Ira, and we'll be watching it through the end of this year and however long it takes.
Mark Aiken is the coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch Program for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, based out of College Park, Maryland. Reducing CO2 is the key way to protect these reefs, but scientists are looking at different ways to rebuild the reefs. And my next guest is restoring reefs down in the Florida Keys. He's doing it by seeding these corals, kind of like you might do in your vegetable garden. David Vaughn is the manager of the Coral Restoration Program at the Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium in Summerland Key, Florida. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about this this program. There are what, two types of corals, the fast-growing and the slow-growing? What's the difference between and how they reproduce?
Yes, our branching corals that many people are familiar with, such as the staghorn, it looks like a deer's antenna, antlers, it is very fast-growing. It's actually evolved to be able to break in a storm and be able to grow back up very quickly. The rest of the corals are actually slower growing, and they're sometimes termed the massive corals or even the reef-building corals. They are the ones you may be familiar with that grow these massive-sized boulders, mountain coral, or even brain coral. And those are the corals that most people did not attempt to try and look to propagate. Most worldwide use of coral restoration was only with the branching corals. But we have found a way to grow very fast and in large numbers the slower growing massive corals.
How do you do that? How have you been successful?
Well, basically, it was one where we made a mistake in that we actually broke a small, tiny piece of some of the larger corals by accident. I think someone called it my Eureka mistake. And it was one which we found out the smaller the size of the piece, the faster it grows. And, of course, then the higher the number of pieces that we get. So a piece of coral that may have started off as a silver dollar as a small brain coral, we would wait 1 or 2 years till it got big enough that we would break it into 2 pieces, and then it would take another 2 years. Now we take that same size coral, break it into 25 to 100 very tiny pieces, which we call termed microfragmenting, and those seems to be stimulated to grow in rapid 25 to 40% faster speed. And so we not only get thousands of corals now in a short period of time, but they continue to grow very fast for about a year or two, just like your skin may grow fast after it's been broken.
So this is, as you say, serendipity, something no one had expected or tried before.
That's correct. There's been a number of mistakes that have turned out to then take the science into action and try it again and prove that it is actually a process that could be utilized as a new technology.
Give me an idea how fast they grow from these tiny little pieces. How big do they get in the period of time?
Well, for instance, with some of the other corals, like elkhorn coral or even the mountain coral, we have also been successful in raising them from egg. In the past, that's only been possible for a couple out of every million to survive. Now we're getting thousands of them to survive. However, for the first 3 years, they grow very slow. After 1 year, they're only the size of a pencil eraser. After 2 years, about the size of a nickel or a dime, and it takes 3 years to get to the size of a quarter. But if we take that quarter size, we can break it into 50 little tiny pieces back down to the size they started, and each one will now grow to the size of a quarter in 3 to 4 months instead of 3 to 4 years.
Wow, that's amazing. Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with David Vaughn of the Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium in Summerlin Key, Florida. So you can now seed the coral beds, or do you have to grow them into larger pieces first?
Well, we usually are taking this technology to first propagate thousands of pieces for outplanting. And we let them grow up to about the size of a silver dollar before outplanting. And that's been very successful. But it's been successful of putting out thousands of small, what I can term baby corals, that will still take 25 to 50 years to get up to the size of a basketball before they're reproductive. But a new technology, actually taken place by one of my scientists, Christopher Page, showed that you can actually plant these small, fast-growing pieces next to each other, and when they grow fast enough to touch and completely touch around themselves, since they came from the same parent coral, they will refuse back into a parent single colony. Just so like, we now plant 10 or 20 pieces of the same from the same parent in an area the size of that basketball. And in 1 to 2 years, they will grow up and touch each other and fuse back into a coral that would have taken 25 to 50 years or more to grow.
Wow. Well, are these coral as sensitive to the warm waters we just talked about in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia? Why are these not being hurt, or is the water not the same?
Well, two things. One is we're using the corals that have made it through these past few years. So we're using the naturally resistant strains that are here today. And second is we have a ocean acidification and high temperature simulator system, sort of an ocean pre-testing system here at the lab, so we can actually test the conditions that we think these corals might be in 50 or 100 years from now, and see which one of these strains — there are many good genetic strains of each of these species — are naturally resistant to the future conditions.
That's terrific. And you're planting this out in the oceans now? How many have you planted? Can we go see them?
Yes, you can. Between our branching corals and our reef-building corals, we've probably planted over 10,000 corals in the Florida Keys. But that is just the beginning. In my calculations, we could literally have hundreds of thousands in 1 to 2 years, and my personal goal is to plant 1 million corals back in the ocean before I retire.
Wow, and who's paying for all of this?
Well, most of this has been started with early testings from places like NOAA. We also get some funding from the same place that Dr. Mark Aitken is from for our Coral Bleach Watch program. But we have had a lot of private investors and private donors, philanthropic people that want to see the reefs back, and we get funding from our Florida Protect Our Reef license plate as well.
Maybe you should start an Adopt a Coral program, you know, like Adopt a Highway, Adopt a Coral.
Instead of adopting one coral, a real intention is to adopt a whole giant coral head. For instance, if we have plenty of coral heads the size of a Volkswagen, we could literally plant 1,000 of these coral baby clones on it, and in 1 to 2 years, get that 300-year-old coral head to come back to life. The other most amazing part about it is, as we take these little babies or seeds and put them together, once they get to the size that would have been a 25 or 50-year-old coral that would have been reproductive, they also are reproductive.
Wow.
So in our laboratory, we've been able to mature a coral to be reproductive in as little as 1 year that would have taken 15 or 25 years. This will let us in the future make replicates of these to test for new resistant strains.
Well, Dr. Vaughn, we wish you great success and your million coral march there. Thank you for...
Oh, thank you very much, Ira.
Good luck to you. David Vaughn is the manager of the Coral Restoration Program at the Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium in Summerland Key, Florida, and talking about some hopeful stuff about corals on Earth Day. And since it is Earth Day, why don't you go out and estimate how many insects are in your backyard? This month, our Science Club is all about taking a sample, and you can learn more at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub and tweet us what you learn with hashtag take a sample. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Luke Raskin is our video producer, and our digital team includes Julie Liebeck, Chow Tu, Brandon Ector, and Daniel Peterschmidt. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Happy Earth Day.